Attention, Vegas. I'm Sergeant Slaughter from the WWE and G.I. Joe, the real American hero. You're watching Solo's Monster Sounds Off podcast right here. Don't touch that dial. And that's in order. Don't make me come looking for you.
It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered!
You like fighting a woman?
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and fight me.
Oh my God, we're only an hour in.
Eric Bischoff is an idiot.
We have 2 more hours of this.
And maybe the single stupidest idiot that ever got into wrestling.
I want out of my contract if I don't get what I want!
I was disappointed Sergeant Slaughter didn't call me a maggot in that intro. I'm not gonna lie. But hey, Maze the Great from our YouTube live stream surprised me with that video from the Hall of Famer himself, so thank you very much for that, Maze. I appreciate that. New Japan Resurgence is tonight in Long Beach with the tournament to crown the first ever New Japan Strong Women's Champion. I'm pulling for a Mercedes Moné Willow Nightingale final. And Hiroshi Tanahashi goes one-on-one with Will Ospreay, with the winner getting Lance Archer at Dominion in a few weeks for the right to challenge Kenny Omega for the IWGP United States Championship. I think it's going to be a good night for Ospreay and Mercedes. It should have been a great week for AEW with the Collision announcement, but it ended up being something very different. I have a lot to say on the latest CM Punk update, as well as the death of superstar Billy Graham. I've got Night of Champions predictions for this Saturday, an update on the AEW Fight Forever video game, the wait may finally be over, and WWE was out with a new list, their ranking of the top 25 best debuts in WWE history, so you know I'm going to have something to say about that. I always have something to say about these WWE lists. We always spend some time on that. So I'm going to take you through the list spot by spot. No NXT this week because I didn't get a chance to watch it, but I did watch the Most Wanted Treasures episode on Macho Man Randy Savage, which actually broke some news, something I don't think anybody knew about before. This is episode 809 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, May 21st, 2023. If you like the show, you can help by dropping a 5-star review for me in Apple Podcasts. You can also get yourself a free audiobook when you use audibletrial.com/solomonster to sign up for a 30-day trial of the Audible service, or 2 free books. If you are an Amazon Prime member, you can download a copy of John Moxley's book, Mox, narrated by Moxley himself, or the Guy Evans Nitro book, the most definitive source on the rise and fall of WCW. Those are two of my top recommendations. So audibletrial.com/solomonster. Of course, if you want to make a PayPal donation, you know where to go. Thesolomonster.com. You'll see the link at the top of the link tree. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout out. I want to say thank you to our PayPal producers for this week. The Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton, Night Stalker, Naif Al-Safar, Big B, Brian Becerra, Killshot, Keith Hart, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, Thunderstorm, Edward Very, the Firebomber, Craig Foster, Daredevil, Doug Lippert, Road Warrior, Roderick Welch, who also wants to give a shout out to Kayla Persons to tell her the Road Warrior said, "Don't be such a brat." He said it, not me. Iowan corn farmer Jesse Lampier. Jesse celebrated his 28th birthday on Friday. Happy birthday, brother. I hope it was like The Rock. I hope it was a great one. And Faisal from Kuwait is a very big fan of the show. He alerted me that his cousin, Suleiman, who's also a big fan, just graduated with a bachelor's degree in management, cum laude, from Bentley University. So I wanted to say congrats to Suleiman. Maybe Tony Khan could use some of his management acumen to help sort things out behind the scenes right now in AEW. He could use all the help he can get. And our friend Nir from Israel, his wife is going through a difficult time right now with her mental health after the birth of their second child last year, and it looks like he's going to be a single parent for a bit. So send any good vibes that you have his way. He could really use it right now. It has been a very eventful few days. I flew down very covertly to Atlanta on Thursday. I wrapped up the Dynamite stream stuff around 2:30 in the morning by the time I was done with everything, and I got about 3 hours of sleep because I had an early flight on Thursday. So for the best surprise party that I have ever been a part of, for Webmaster Mike of SE Scoops fame, as many of you know, my show got started on SE Scoops 16 years ago, and I've been friends with Mike for a lot longer than that. He's turning the big 4-0 next month, and his wife put the entire thing together where there would be friends and family waiting for him at the Nightmare Factory, which, as you may or may not know, is run by Cody Rhodes and QT Marshall. Only Mike had no idea he was going to the Nightmare Factory. He had no idea where he was going, period. He was blindfolded in the car, which is really scary because he was driving. But he was blindfolded as she brought him inside, and there we all were. So you can imagine the look of surprise on his face. He's looking around. He sees two rings. There, you know, off in the distance is the big Hell in a Cell poster from last year with Cody on it. And there's championship belts in glass cases on the wall. You know, all the belts that that Cody has held. And then the Cody throne from Double or Nothing is sitting right there. So he got in the ring with QT Marshall and some of his students to learn how to take a bump and how to run the ropes, which is not a fun thing to do if you do it the wrong way and you take it with the top rope underneath your armpit. As I learned, you've got to have that middle rope hitting the crack of your back. But Mike did pretty well with everything. He even got to have a tag team match with some of the students who were all great about it. And then after all that, he got the big bomb dropped on him, and out came Cody. In full suit, of course. And we all hung out for about an hour and in the ring for a little bit. And it was very interesting. You know, I asked him whether he prefers WWE's ring ropes, because they use actual rope, if he prefers that to the cable ropes. And he likes the WWE ones, but the New Japan rings are his favorite. He says it's like they use garden hose for their ropes. And maybe it's not literally garden hoses, but that's what their ropes are like. You could always see the difference between the WWE rings and the WCW rings. You know, the way the cruiserweights would be able to spring off the ropes and how much looser the WWE ones always were. So, and, you know, we got to sit under the learning tree for a little while. A lot of stuff we asked about that I won't repeat. It was very insightful. And I want to thank Cody, QT, and the Nightmare Factory for one hell of a birthday surprise. And Mike's incredible wife for making it all happen. It was all her. We were just there for the ride. Yeah, I told him, I said, you're going to have a hell of a job ahead of you when it's your turn to return the favor. I don't know what he's going to do, but that's for him to worry about. I only wish my stay in Atlanta could have been longer than 24 hours, because as soon as we wrapped up at the Nightmare Factory, I headed back to my hotel. And I got another 3 hours of sleep for a 4:30 wake up. I booked the earliest flight that I could to get back to New York, because we had a big House of Glory show coming up on Friday night, and I didn't want to take any chances, but I had to fly Delta. I like flying JetBlue. I took JetBlue out there, but I had to book Delta for the return flight. And I thought, surely they won't fuck me. I haven't flown anywhere since that Jericho cruise I was on right before COVID shut everything down. But before that, my experiences with Delta were mixed. Let's just say mixed at best. So I figured, it's been over 3 years, it's just one flight, it's early in the morning, surely everything will be okay. So we boarded on time, I only had carry-on, right, that makes life a lot easier. I'm all buckled up, I'm ready to watch Batista's Knock at the Cabin on my phone for the ride home, I've been meaning to watch this movie. And we sit there, and we sit there, and we sit there, for over an hour. Until finally they tell us, there's a mechanical issue with the plane, something with the navigation system, and they're trying to fix it, right? And I already knew. They're not fixing this. They're not fixing this. I'm fucked. And of course, they couldn't fix it, and they told all of us to deplane and head back to the gate. So now I'm thinking, I'm not going to make this show. All the other flights were sold out. Thankfully, 90 minutes later, they found us a different plane. We boarded, we took off. And when we landed, you know, everyone stands up, they grab their shit because they're in such a rush to get off the plane. That would be me. trying to get away from, I'm trying to get away from the screaming child two rows behind me. They can't get the door open. Either they can't get it open or they won't open it because we were told there's some sort of gate issue and they're waiting for somebody to come and try to fix it or address it. So that was another 30 minutes until they finally let us off. I did watch the movie, by the way. I thought it was boring. I thought the only redeeming part of that movie was Batista's performance. I thought Batista was great. He was fantastic in that movie. But I just thought the movie itself was very dull. I'm not even sure why the movie had an R rating. You know, whatever violence there is, it's not even shown on camera. And evidently the movie is based off of a book that had a much better ending that kind of keeps you guessing. And I guess they changed the ending for the movie, which made it worse. I haven't read the book, but I read what the ending was, and I would agree. I think that would have been a much better ending. I don't think we always need things spelled out for us. Sometimes it's better to leave people guessing and kind of leave it to their imagination. But I had just enough time to get home, take a shower, get dressed, and get over to the House of Glory show, Beware the Fury. We had a packed house at the NYC Arena to see Matt Cardona, the Deathmatch King, with his queen, Steph Delander, beating Jacob Fatu to win the House of Glory World Heavyweight Championship. Fatu's six-month reign comes to an end. Cardona said he is taking the title back to Orlando, Florida with him because New York City sucks. And we had main event in the Motor City Machine Guns. They had a banger, as did Charles Mason and Jake Something. I hate to say anything positive about Mason, just because he's a terrible, shitty human being. But he had a hell of a match, and he is still our crown jewel champion. It was great meeting many of you. It was great to be back on Fight TV with JD and the Professor on commentary. We're going to be live on Fight again for our next show, Friday, June 16th, for the debut of El Hijo del Vikingo. I have been waiting to call my first Vikingo match. Thankfully, I don't have to do the play-by-play. I'm just there for the color. I kind of feel like it's not an easy thing to follow Vikingo and call play-by-play for one of his matches, but that'll be a fun one. HOGWrestling.net, front row is already sold out, but you can still grab ringside seats before they're gone. WWE Hall of Famer superstar Billy Graham died on Wednesday, 1 month short of his 80th birthday. He had been in the hospital for months with various infections. I know he had gone deaf. He lost over 80 pounds. Sepsis and multiple organ failure was the cause of death. His wife, Valerie, in a Facebook post on Monday, said that he was on life support and the doctors wanted to take him off, but she refused and she was praying for a miracle. Like so many of the other times, he kicked out at 2.5, but there was no kicking out this time. It's amazing he survived as long as he did, considering all the health issues that he's had for the past few decades. He had a liver transplant back in 2002. All the years of steroid abuse just ravaged this man's body. He even cut promos back in the day talking about how he was going to take 7 Deanna balls a day. And I mean, can you imagine Hulk Hogan coming out before WrestleMania 3 and talking about upping his decadorabolin cycles so he could slam that? He could slam that nasty, stinky 800-pound giant. But, you know, that's just how it was. And he was one of the greatest promo guys in the history of the business and one of the most influential. Without him, there would be no Hulk Hogan. There would be no Jesse the Body Ventura, who clearly modeled large aspects of their characters and their promo styles after Billy Graham. And Hogan was the top star of his generation. There was no bigger name. No more widely recognized name in wrestling at that time than, and really in that entire decade, than Hulk Hogan. Had Superstar come along 5 or 10 years later, maybe it would have been him instead of Hogan, but, you know, he was ahead of his time in that way. And without Hogan and Hulkamania taking off when it did, who knows where WWE would be today? You know, the reason Vince McMahon calls his wrestlers superstars is because of superstar Billy Graham. And just what he represented, that it wasn't just about how good of a wrestler someone was and the moves that they knew. It was about the total package. You know, their look, their verbal skills, their charisma, their personality. That's what makes someone a superstar. And so now everyone is a superstar, even though very few of them actually have the verbal skills and the charisma that Graham had. But he won the world title, his one and only run with the belt from Bruno Sammartino in 1977. That ended Bruno's second run with the championship. That was not his 8-year run. This was the 3-year run that he had, which, you know, they will claim that Roman Reigns is going to beat that run when he passes him, if he passes him. But he really won't, because Roman's longer run is with the Universal title. It's not with the WWE title. Unified or not, it does not matter. That's not going to stop them from claiming it anyway. But Graham was a huge draw as the heel champion. Tons of sellouts in Madison Square Garden and other places. They were doing big business at the box office with him on top, which is why he tried to convince Vince Sr. not to take the belt off of him and put it on Bob Backlund, which was McMahon's plan from day one, from the very day that Superstar Graham won that championship. I mean, you talk about long-term booking. He was told months ahead of time that he was going to be winning the title, right down to the date that he would be dropping it. And Vince Sr. was adamant that we are not changing from these plans. Bob Backlund is my guy. We're not changing from this plan. And when he lost the title, he went into a deep depression. He was never the same again. You know, he left the company for a while. He dropped off the face of the earth. He got out of the wrestling business completely. He wanted nothing to do with it, to the point that people thought he was dead. There were rumors about him being dead. I covered this a few years ago in one of my This Week in Wrestling History segments. This was in 1981. Gorilla Monsoon had a weekly column in the Philadelphia Journal. And in one of his columns, he announced that superstar Billy Graham had died of cancer in his hometown of Paradise Alley, Arizona, or Paradise Valley. Well, that came as news to Billy Graham because he was still very much alive. And as the story goes, Monsoon had heard a rumor that he died, and so he went with it. No fact-checking, he just went with it in his column. When Graham came back the following year looking like a different person, he was a lot smaller. He was doing a kung fu type karate gimmick. I think he may have shaved his head. He didn't draw well in Philly, probably because people thought he really was dead. And it was an imposter Billy Graham. And Monsoon never did print a retraction. Of all the stories to print a retraction for, claiming that someone was dead when they're really not would seem to qualify. But when the kung fu stuff fizzled out, Vince Jr. brought him back again in 86, and this is the run that I remember, because this is around the time I started watching WWE. His run as champion, that came before my time. So the first that I knew of superstar Billy Graham, I remember seeing him at one of the Slammy Awards ceremonies. I don't know if he was accepting an award or giving an award, something with Hulk Hogan on stage. I have only vague memories of which one that was. Might have been 87. But I remember him being the manager for Don Morocco. Who, by the way, Don Morocco, pretty damn underrated promo guy himself. If you're not familiar with him, you need to check out his work. But one of the earliest angles I remember on TV was Graham. He was still in great shape when you would look at him. You know, he still had the big biceps. But he had very bad hip issues. He was not moving around very well. I remember the angle. He was being held down by Slick and Butch Reed as One Man Gang came off the ropes and splashed him. And I think they were writing him off TV, and that turned out to be his last in-ring appearance. That was it. I know he did commentary for a while, then he had a falling out with Vince, which would not be his first, or his only one. He testified in 91 in the Dr. Zahorian steroid trial that he had purchased large quantities of steroids from Zahorian back in the 70s and the 80s. The following year, he appeared on that infamous episode of Phil Donahue's show. And what a cast of characters that was on that stage. You had Bruno Sammartino on the far end, on the far right. Billy Graham is sitting next to him. John Arezzi, who is a radio show wrestling host at the time, he was next to him. Dave Meltzer, and then next to Meltzer and his mullet, was Vince McMahon. And that was only the right half of who was on that stage. He was on Donahue claiming that he shot up Hulk Hogan with steroids, and that he personally witnessed Pat Patterson sexually abusing one of the ring boys, which he later admitted was a lie, and he made it all up. And later on, he said that it was the most shameful moment of his life. In the September 1993 issue of the WWF magazine, Meltzer had a mention in his bio about a column in the magazine, and it rang a bell with me, because I still have all of my WWF magazines. I started collecting the magazines in early 92, Shortly after Flair came in, I had a subscription, and I still have all, I have all the magazines. And there was a magazine, the September 1993 issue of the WWF magazine, had a column called Now It's Our Turn. This was the first of what was supposed to be a series of columns called Now It's Our Turn, where they would respond to various media outlets and disgruntled wrestlers who were critical of them and critical of the product. Today, it would be the equivalent of responding to the news websites or podcasts like this one. I should be so honored that they would ever think to respond to anything that I have to say. But as somebody who was reading those magazines back then, it was completely out of character for that magazine to do a feature like this, because a lot of what was in there was mostly just kayfabe stories about the wrestlers and personality profiles and pay-per-view results and fantasy warfare and trivia. It was geared towards kids. Kids and teenagers. So imagine a 9-year-old seeing this Now It's Our Turn talking about superstar Billy Graham, a wrestler they wouldn't even know of because he was before their time, you know, talking about him testifying as a rebuttal witness on behalf of the government and the steroid trial. Just imagine processing this as a child. Yeah, this was a 2-page feature, no less. It had 4 columns of text. This was not like a short couple of paragraphs talking about their own investigation into who is the real Billy Graham. And they called him a high school dropout who never held a regular job, who had tax liens against him and non-support orders against him for 2 children he left behind when he was married for the 5th time. I swear, it's like Vince wrote this himself. There's something very appropriate about Lex Luger being the one on the cover of that issue, showing off all of his muscles. So it got real nasty, and Graham was no innocent angel in all this. Nobody came out of that looking good. They all came off looking like scumbags, except Bruno. Bruno never came off that way. But they thought so little of this man, that didn't stop them from inducting him into the Hall of Fame. They didn't have any issue inducting this high school dropout tax delinquent steroid abuser into their Hall of Fame in 2004. So since then, Graham, he's had his on and off battles with the company. Usually whenever somebody had something bad to say about him, or when Vince cut off his allowance, you know, basically they were paying him for a time. And when they stopped paying him, he turned against them real quick. You know, and when Chris Jericho said some things about him for commenting in the media after the Chris Benoit murder-suicide, and I think also for trying to control Jericho's speaking time during Eddie Guerrero's funeral, because Graham was leading the funeral, and he supposedly limited people to only a few minutes of speaking time. Jericho didn't know at the time that Graham and Eddie were close, that they knew each other. Graham even bought a burial plot in Arizona next to Eddie. And Jericho made a crack about it during his speech, I think, and Graham just blew up on him for it, which was not the time nor the place. But there's a famous shoot interview with Billy Graham where he literally wishes death upon Chris Jericho. He says he'll burn in hell, he'll happily cut out his tongue, and he'll watch as he bleeds to death on his own blood, among other over-the-top things that he said. You know, look, you take the good with the bad. I've covered all of this on the podcast over the years. You've heard me tell these stories before when it comes to Billy Graham. Just because he passed away doesn't mean I'm going to shy away from it. But I can also acknowledge just how big of an influence he was on the wrestling business and how successful he was when he was at his peak. Unfortunately for him, his peak didn't last as long as it should have because Vince Sr. was very set in his ways. Who knows how many more years he could have been champion for? Who knows how many more sellouts he could have had? And then maybe turned around and gotten a big babyface run out of it when he eventually turned. That didn't happen. And it's awful, all of the health issues that he had to go through, even if a lot of it was self-inflicted, and he was very open about that and talking about, you know, the way he abused his body with steroids. But still, nobody should have to go through the hell that he had to go through with his health over the years. WWE Night of Champions is coming up this Saturday. I'm going to run down the card and give my predictions in a bit. On Raw Monday night, Paul Heyman was allowed on the show, even though he's on SmackDown now because he had a visitor's pass. He was there to conspire with the Judgment Day and Imperium to take out Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn, I would assume, in exchange for a guarantee At a future tag team title match, should Roman Reigns and Solo Sikoa win the titles at Night of Champions? Otherwise, I'm not sure why they would even give Heyman the time of day, or what he could actually do for them or promise any of them. Finn Balor and Damian Priest beat Owens and Zayn in a non-title match to close out the show. They actually did a good job of setting up two more challengers for them after Night of Champions in the Judgment Day and Imperium, two heel teams, which makes it even more likely than it already was that they're going to retain on Saturday. All three members of Imperium are wrestling Owens, Zayn, and a mystery partner tomorrow night. My guess would be Matt Riddle, since Imperium caused him to be eliminated from the Battle Royal on Monday. A Battle Royal to crown a new number one contender to Gunther's Intercontinental title at Night of Champions. A Battle Royal that was won by Mustafa Ali. Triple H did with Bronson Reed what he did with him in the Elimination Chamber match this year. He kept him as strong as possible, even though he wasn't going over. Reed has probably been my favorite of all the names that were let go that Triple H brought back. He's the one who made good forward progress so far. Hopefully that continues. He really has not had a good program for himself yet, but they've kept him strong. And except for that one match with Lashley, which I thought could have been better, but he was sick with the flu and we didn't know, he's looked good in every appearance that I've seen him in. If you saw the previous matches with Gunther and Ricochet, this one with Ali on Saturday is not going to be much different. You're going to get what you expect. A very good match, but the title is not in any real jeopardy whatsoever. I don't think it will be until after he breaks the all-time record in September. And that's around the time that it would make sense to get the title off of him and start getting him primed for a run at the World Heavyweight Championship. You know, Gunther is right now the number one heel on Monday Night Raw. The number one heel should be in the mix for the top title on that brand. And they have time because they haven't even crowned the first champion yet. But I'm saying when you get to that latter part of 2023 and he's, you know, beaten the Honky Tonk Man's record and everybody's happy, that is the time to begin to get him primed for a spot in that world title picture. They made it very clear that Gunther and Imperium are going to be a force on that show. More so Gunther than the other two, but collectively Imperium was made to be a big deal. Even something as small as them walking through the hallway and having Akira Tozawa, you know, turn and walk the other direction because he was afraid of Gunther. It's the little things like that that mean the most sometimes. The presentation of Imperium and the use of video packages to introduce us to some of the new faces from NXT were the two things I liked the most about the show on Monday. One thing Shawn Michaels does very well on NXT is the use of videos to profile their talent. Existing talent, new talent, you know, the barbershop segments with Carmelo Hayes and Trick Williams, all the segments with Briggs and Jensen and Fallon Henley at the bar, the bar segments with Gallus when they were drinking beer and shooting pool, yeah, even some of the Tony D'Angelo stuff, as corny as it is, he puts a lot of emphasis on those types of segments. He uses them a lot. We don't get enough of that on the main roster. On Monday alone, we had vignettes for Apollo Crews and JD McDonagh that were very well done, especially the McDonagh one, you know, the Irish ace, as they're calling him. I didn't like that they just threw him and Von Wagner and Zion Quinn in the Battle Royal, and most people didn't know who they were, so when they got dumped, they didn't care. But they used McDonagh's elimination by Dolph Ziggler to then kickstart a program with him and Ziggler when he attacked Dolph outside the ring. And then later in the show, he was interviewed on his way out of the building, and he explained why he targeted Dolph. He says, because he's been around for so long and he's accomplished so much. And then as he was walking away at the very end, you could see Finn Balor come into frame. He was watching McDonagh as he walked off, planting the seeds for him to possibly join the Judgment Day. I expect the Judgment Day to expand, just like I expect The Way to expand now that they have Johnny and Candice and Dexter and Indy Hartwell back together. They're going to bring back The Way. We've already gotten a little tease from Gargano that Tommaso Ciampa may be back soon and joining their little family. You know, Candice is suddenly sticking up for Nikki Cross when she was being bullied backstage by Zoe Stark. Maybe that means Nikki Cross might join The Way. I don't know. You know, if Shawn Michaels is big on vignettes, Triple H is big on factions. It's one of the things that is very apparent when you watch WWE television is how big Triple H is on factions. And we have a lot of them right now across both brands, We have the Bloodline. We have the Judgment Day. We have Imperium. We have the LWO. We have the OC. We have the Brawling Brutes. Damage Control for now. And now we have the Way. So he loves his stables. It's one thing about his style of booking that's always been very noticeable. And it's not surprising if you think about his background. He spent most of his career in factions. In DX. And the Corporation. And the McMahon-Helmsley regime. And Evolution. And then DX again. And then the Authority. He probably has spent the most time in factions out of every top star in WWE history. Indusher is another future contender for KO and Sammy's tag team titles. They made their Raw debut, managed by Jinder Mahal, and absolutely destroyed the local losers that they put them in the ring with. I like that the pendulum is finally swinging the other way when it comes to the tag team division. Triple H is finally taking steps to strengthen the tag division. Now he has to do the same with the women's division, but that's going to take time. But they just shook up the rosters and introduced some new faces from NXT. You know, Rome wasn't built in a day. Hopefully they pick up the pace because they have no compelling stories in the women's mid-card right now, and that's been a problem for a while. But you can definitely notice the difference. I'm not going to sit here and tell you it's the strongest tag team scene in WWE history. That would be a lie. But it's definitely stronger, I would say, than it was a year ago. And bringing in some new faces like an Indusher will only strengthen that division. Ronda Rousey and Shayna Baszler, they are back. They attack Raquel Rodriguez after her match. There was no Liv Morgan on the show Monday night. She suffered an injury the previous week and was not medically cleared. Ronda came sliding in with a kick. Sliding in off camera. They were on stage. Sliding in with a kick. Fell on her ass. She made it clear they were not waiting. They wanted a shot at the women's tag team titles. They will not have to wait very long. Because on Friday, WWE announced that Liv Morgan and Raquel have vacated the women's tag team titles due to Liv's injury, which is said to be more serious than originally thought. Well, clearly it is more serious than originally thought. On SmackDown, they showed a replay of the spot where supposedly it happened, which may have been different than what they showed on Monday. So I don't know if this was the actual spot that the injury took place, but it showed Liv down in the corner. And Dakota Kai came charging in with a kick. And the way that she collided with Liv and Liv holding her arm after, it looked like maybe a shoulder injury or a collarbone injury. I can't be sure because they haven't told us what it is. But the fact that she is going to be out for a while, you know, look, if it was something like a concussion, they wouldn't be stripping them of the title so soon. With a concussion, you could be cleared in a week. You could be cleared in 6 weeks. They just wouldn't know this soon. So the fact that they did this would indicate that that's not what this is. So next Monday, not tomorrow night, but next Monday after Night of Champions, they're going to have a fatal four-way to crown new women's tag team champions with Raquel and a mystery partner, Ronda Rousey and Shayna Baszler, Bayley and Io Sky, and it's going to be Sonya Deville and Chelsea Green rounding out the field. On SmackDown, Bayley claimed that Dakota Kai was also hurt in that match last week that Liv Morgan got hurt in. I don't know if that's legit. I don't know if that's just a storyline explanation, but it conveniently gets Bayley and Io together as a team so they could further the damage control split when they don't win. Raquel's partner, who knows? Watch it be Natty or Shotzi or something like that. Ronda and Shayna, they're going to win the titles. They were always winning the titles. Ronda's injury just delayed things a bit, but they're going to win the titles. Isla Dawn made a great point on Twitter when WWE made the announcement about the belts being vacated. She said, "Is this necessary? Is this necessary when the one and only women's tag team champions are right here?" And that's true. They are the NXT women's tag team champions. They have the NXT women's tag belts with them now on SmackDown. They just made their debut on Friday night. And I still feel very strongly the women's tag team titles and the NXT women's tag team titles should be merged. The problem is the timing. The timing is not great. Alba and Isla, they just debuted. And I hate the idea of sacrificing them this early to Ronda Rousey. So, reluctantly, I would crown new women's tag team champions and then you build to an eventual unification match. A true unification. Not a unification where the winners carry four belts around instead of two. So anyway, there was a lot of storyline progression on Raw, even though I didn't think the show was very exciting. There was a lot of storyline progression. SmackDown, I did not get to watch until Saturday. It was all about the Bloodline, as SmackDown has been for almost 3 years now, and the slow destruction of the Bloodline with Roman Reigns being upset with the Usos. The Usos are on the outs. They advertised a face-to-face for this show with Reigns, Solo Sikoa, Kevin Owens, and Sami Zayn, which was interrupted by the Usos attacking Sami and KO. They thought they were doing a good thing. Roman, though, got all pissed off that they upstaged him. They didn't let him finish what he had to say to them. And then Roman accidentally, when he went to go leave, he accidentally bumped Solo Sikoa. And it was such a little thing, but I loved how Roman at first, if you go back and watch, he looked like he was going to admonish him for it, like he maybe was going to say something to Solo about it. But then he got a look on his face like he thought better of it, and he just kept walking. And Solo just stood there with his back to the aisle, but he was sort of giving Roman the side eye, like he wasn't very happy about that. I've said it before, when Roman finally loses Solo, his reign is over. Solo is the last soldier he's got left. Solo's all about loyalty. And when that's gone, Roman has nothing left. And then at the end of the show, the Usos lost to Rey Mysterio and Santos Escobar. And the LWO never beats anybody. Unless it's Dominic. Or at least Santos Escobar doesn't beat anybody. So Roman should be doubly pissed at the fact that they lost to the LWO. They cut to the back with Roman, Heyman, Solo. They were all watching. Solo went to go stand up like he was going to go handle business. Roman stopped him. So some palace intrigue heading into the Bloodline match in Night of Champions. After you peel back the Bloodline layer of the SmackDown onion, the rest of this show was pretty boring. Pretty Deadly made their SmackDown debut with a win over Butch and Ridge Holland. Pretty Deadly, noticeable lack of reaction from the crowd, but it was only their first appearance. The important thing is they won. Asuka got a win over Zelina Vega because she's challenging Bianca Belair at Night of Champions. When Bianca came out to make the save after Asuka spit the mist in her face again, I think the idea was that Bianca would dodge it, so she didn't sell it at all. The problem is, a lot of the blue goo got all over her. It was all on her face, it was all over her chest. So it was weird, you know, after seeing her sell like a wild woman the week before, here it didn't affect her at all. But I guess Asuka did say it was some sort of chili pepper mist the first time, so maybe that's why. Maybe that's why. No chili in this mist. I guess it has no effect on you then. AJ Styles was a guest on the Grayson Waller Effect, which ended with Waller predicting a Seth Rollins win at Night of Champions, and then AJ got up in his face, and the segment just ended. So they set up two possible future opponents for AJ on this show, Grayson Waller, who he's had a beef with before in NXT, and Karrion Kross, who had a segment with Scarlett where she pulled out a tarot card that had AJ's face on it. TikTok. Yes, TikTok until Karrion Kross loses another match this Friday. The Street Profits beat LA Knight and Rick Boogs. Boogie Knights. Actually, they had a different name, but it was fucking shit, so we'll go with this name. Boogie Knights. This lasted all of 1 week, thank God. Boogs took the losing fall, Knight dropped him after the match, so now we'll get the singles match between LA Knight and Rick Boogs. My guess, though, is they have Knight find even more partners to try to, you know, beat the Street Profits, and you know my idea from last week with Cameron Grimes. It's not too late. I know they're probably going to have a program with him and Baron Corbin. They're probably going to extend that program. It's not too late. Fightful had a report about Grimes this week. They said Cameron Grimes has a lot of fans backstage, including Triple H. One longtime WWE employee said that they see Grimes as a slam dunk. He could absolutely be a breakout babyface at some point. I've said that for a long time. It's nice to hear that he's got the right people there in his corner. Austin Theory, he was on the show. He talked about being ganged up on by Bobby Lashley and Sheamus in the triple threat match the week before, that World Heavyweight title tournament. And he couldn't understand why Sheamus had such a problem with him, which brought out Sheamus, who gave him a brogue kick, and then he left. So that now sets up a match for SmackDown this Friday between the two of them. And then we had the main event with the LWO and the Usos. So if you missed the show on Friday, you didn't miss much, which is something I can say sadly about most WWE programming since WrestleMania. Night of Champions is coming up this, except for Backlash. Backlash was fucking great. Everything else, very missable. But Night of Champions is coming up this Saturday from Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, with a 1 o'clock Eastern start on Peacock. I will be live after the show on YouTube with a full review. Normally at Night of Champions, all the titles are defended. But Roman Reigns is wrestling for the tag team titles, so his titles are not on the line. The women's tag titles are vacant. And as of now, there is no SmackDown Women's Championship match. But I do expect them to add Rhea Ripley against Natalya tomorrow night. I'll be surprised if they don't add that to the pay-per-view. Based on what they did on Friday, I expected them to add Austin Theory against Sheamus for the U.S. title. But again, they already announced the match for SmackDown on Friday, which was taped the other night, since they're going to be traveling this Friday. I haven't seen the spoilers, but I know the match, it did happen. So unless there's a reason for a rematch, it doesn't look like the U.S. title is being defended. We have Becky Lynch one-on-one with Trish Stratus. There's no way this is one and done. So I'm picking Trish to win, keep the program going, because if Becky wins, what's the point? Gunther defends the Intercontinental Championship against Mustafa Ali. I mean, do I even have to say it? Of course, Gunther retains. Bianca Belair will defend the Raw Women's Championship against Asuka. Two SmackDown stars fighting for the Raw belt. Bianca has over 400 days as champion. And she already won at WrestleMania. She already beat Asuka. I don't see them taking the title off of her the second time around. So Bianca retains. Cody Rhodes, one-on-one with Brock Lesnar in a fight. If anybody bleeds this time, it's going to be Cody. I was surprised that he didn't bleed in the last match. I was surprised Brock was the one bleeding. If there's any blood this time, Cody's going to be wearing blood. This one is not a slam dunk. You know, adding the fight stipulation means they can use weapons. And like the last man standing match Brock had with Roman Reigns at SummerSlam last year, when you have access to plunder, they can use it on Brock and beat him that way. And if Cody beats him back-to-back times, then he could win Money in the Bank, and he could call his shot against Roman Reigns at SummerSlam. I'm going a different way with this. I'm picking Brock this time, which then necessitates a third and deciding match between the two at Money in the Bank. Cody does not need to win Money in the Bank if he's already on SmackDown, which leads me to this next match. To decide a brand new World Heavyweight Champion on Monday Night Raw, it is Seth Rollins against AJ Styles, who was just drafted to SmackDown with the other three members of the OC. Rollins is about to make history this weekend by becoming the first WWE star to wrestle in the deciding match for three different brand new championships. First, it was the NXT title tournament in 2012. Then it was the Universal Championship in 2016. And now the World Heavyweight Championship in 2023. I know Rollins is the betting favorite here, and that title has his name on it, but that doesn't mean he has to win it right now. 2 weeks ago, I would have absolutely picked Seth Rollins. Last week, I pitched a different idea, and it may be pie in the sky, but I like pie. Who among us doesn't like to have a little slice of pie every now and then? I'm picking AJ Styles for the surprise win, because I would like to think that Triple, and maybe it's wishful thinking on my part, but I would like to think that Triple H including SmackDown talent in this tournament was about more than just giving us an attraction in the finals with Rollins and Styles. I would like to think that there was a method to the madness. Styles wins, which forces him back to Monday nights, and he takes the entire OC with him, because all four of them were drafted together as a package deal, so why would they be separated? Anderson and Gallows are dead in the water without AJ Styles. I mean, they're barely head above water, even with Styles. They are dead in the water without AJ. Mia Yim doesn't have to be with them to be successful, but she's better off with them than she is without them. So all four of them move to Raw. And Rollins can feud with AJ for the world title through SummerSlam. Well, then, what does that, you know, what does that mean for SmackDown? What does SmackDown get in return? A trade of equal or greater value, and Cody Rhodes would qualify. The same Cody Rhodes who beat Seth Rollins three straight times last year. The same Cody Rhodes who won the Royal Rumble. The same Cody Rhodes who headlined WrestleMania this year. Cody goes to SmackDown. He gets to finish the story there. Maybe wishful thinking, but that's my prediction. And for the undisputed tag team titles, Roman Reigns and Solo Sikoa team for the very first time to challenge Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn. Sami has never worked one of these big Saudi shows before. He has wrestled in Saudi Arabia for them, against Damian Sandow, in fact. That was 9 years ago. But with Syria being accepted back into the Arab League, the politics have changed now between Saudi Arabia and Syria. So Sami is allowed to go back there, and he is elected to do so. Kevin Owens worked the Greatest Royal Rumble in 2018. That was the very first big Saudi show they did, but he elected not to go back after that in a show of support for his friend. Now that Sami is going, Owens is going too. And they're both going to win and retain their tag team titles when the Usos get involved. And somehow, they screw things up royally for Roman and Solo, and they keep the self-destruction of the bloodline going. So no title changes on the show other than a new world champion being crowned. That is my prediction. Even if Rhea Ripley gets added. I mean, if Rhea Ripley against Natty gets added, I mean, come on. No title changes on this show. Again, I'll be live on YouTube right after for the recap, and hopefully I will see you all there. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. You know, I get questions from time to time about my work week. What does it look like? I spend a lot of time working on this show, whether it's prep for Sunday or the weekly live streams, bonus content, editing, you know, it's a lot. But I love it. The problem sometimes is that I put too much into it at the expense of what I need for myself, like free time and sleep. That can have me feeling like I'm burning the candle at both ends. You may feel that way too if you're giving a lot of yourself to others and not enough to yourself. Therapy can give you the tools to find more balance in your life. It can help you learn important coping skills and how to set boundaries. It's not just for people who have suffered some sort of trauma in their lives. It has benefits for everyone. And that's why you should give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to fit into your schedule, no matter how busy you may be. All you do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find more balance with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Solomonster today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Solomonster. It was a week that Tony Khan should have been able to celebrate, with Warner Brothers Discovery adding 2 more hours of live AEW content on Saturday nights, and AEW having just sold over 60,000 tickets a few weeks ago for its Wembley Stadium debut. He should have been riding high on cloud nine. Instead, he is once again dealing with drama surrounding CM Punk. Drama that not only overshadowed the Collision announcement, but could very well doom the entire show before it even airs a single episode. At the upfronts on Wednesday at Madison Square Garden, AEW Collision was officially announced as a new weekly 2-hour series airing live from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern starting June 17th. The new logo, very much inspired by the old WCW Monday Nitro logo, which I think is cool, you know, given the show is airing on the same network Nitro did, and I would love to see them adopt a Nitro-esque stage and set for the show. The headliners mentioned in the press release and seen on the official poster were Samoa Joe, Miro, Thunder Rosa, Powerhouse Hobbs, and Andrade El Idolo. MJF was on the poster, as was Orange Cassidy, FTR, and the House of Black, all of whom are currently title holders, which I take to mean that the champions will be floating between Dynamite and Collision, even if there is some sort of unofficial brand split. I don't think they're going to have a draft or anything the way WWE does it, but there clearly is going to be a separation of some sort between the two rosters, and we're going to see people on Saturdays who we may not get to see very often, if at all, on Wednesdays. Letting champions float between the shows as needed, that's the right way to go. Except, I do think the TNT champion should be exclusive to the TNT shows, and the TBS champion should be on the TBS show. Despite all the rumors of the new media rights deal being announced, there was no mention of any new deal, although they must have made some sort of new deal, at least for Collision. I mean, they're adding over 100 new hours of live television a year. I sure hope they're not doing that for free. But we don't know if that deal is separate from Dynamite and Rampage or if everything is lumped together. The current deal expires in September. Warner does have the option of extending that deal into September of next year. But nothing was mentioned. That includes any potential streaming deal. I still think All In ends up streaming on Max, which launches this Tuesday. Because there's still been nothing said about how people who aren't at Wembley Stadium are going to be able to see the show. And there's got to be a reason why they're holding back on that. The one AEW show that you will be able to watch on Max starting June 9th is AEW All Access. All six episodes will be archived there. HBO Max already has the first season of Roads to the Top on there. There was supposed to be a second season before Cody left, so it's possible whatever deal they had for that show extended to All Access, which basically took the place of Roads to the Top Season 2. But for now, that's the only AEW content that you'll be able to stream on the, on Max. If it does eventually end up that AEW moves to streaming all of its pay-per-views and special events on Max, one potential downside would be if they decide to start running them monthly, like WWE does. I like the current AEW model of five pay-per-views a year. They've got Revolution, they've got Double or Nothing, now they have Forbidden Door, which is fun for the fans who also like New Japan. You get the, you know, inter-promotional matches once a year. You've got All Out, and you've got Full Gear. All In would qualify as, I guess, a special. I don't know if that's going to be an annual thing. It might be. But I like the way the current model is set up. It allows Tony Khan to spread the events out, make those shows feel special, save his bigger matches for those five shows. I would hate to see that change. You know, six also. Six would be fine if they want All In to be an annual thing. I'm cool with that, but I mean, do they really need 8 to 12 shows a year? I don't think they do. I mean, it's the way of the world now with WWE and UFC. I get that, but I just don't think it's something they need. Jason Sarlanis, the president of Turner Network, said that adding Collision will allow them to, quote, satisfy the massive demand we felt from our hardcore fan base, which is, I think, a pretty good indicator that the Turner folks, they're more than happy to appeal to the hardcore AEW fan base. For all the people who wonder, oh, how will they grow their audience and how will they grow their audience to appeal to the casual fan? Turner doesn't seem to be too bothered by that right now. And that's good news if you're a fan of the current AEW product the way that it is. If you're not, well, sucks to be you, I guess. But if you're a fan of the way things are currently in AEW, that should come as a positive bit of news. Warner Brothers Discovery is doubling down on AEW. That really should be the headline. Instead, the headlines were about who was missing from the announcement and from the poster. And that's CM Punk. Punk was initially listed in the press release. He was going to be announced as the main star of the show, but less than 24 hours before, AEW told Warner Brothers Discovery to remove Punk from all of the materials, which they did. But some email links that went out had CM Punk's name on it in the headline, even though when you clicked on the link and it took you to the announcement, his name was nowhere to be found. That's how last minute the change was. They had all their email blasts ready to go, and they forgot to take his name out. Comicbook.com reached out to Warner directly and was told CM Punk is not affiliated with TNT's AEW Collision. Fightful indicated that there were still plans for Punk to return as of this week, and the changes were last minute. Clearly, there were plans for Punk to return because they had Samoa Joe in the announcement, even though he's on Ring of Honor as their current television champion. Why else would he be on there if not for the fact that Punk wanted to work with Joe, which we heard about last week, and clearly he was getting his wish. But now, everything is up in the air. Mike Johnson of PW Insider on Wednesday reported that the rumor making the rounds is that Punk and AEW are again at odds, now over the status of the return of Ace Steel. In asking around, there appears to be something to that situation. The belief among those we've spoken with is that Steel was expected to return in conjunction with Punk next month and working behind the scenes. However, the story making its way around AEW backstage at Dynamite is that a decision was made that Steel would not be working backstage at the actual tapings. As you might imagine, that left Punk and AEW on opposite sides of the discussion, which in turn led to Punk being removed from all promotional material released for the Collision series. One person believed MJF replaced Punk in the graphic for the series, but we have not been able to confirm that yet with multiple sources. We do know that Impact Wrestling had interest in bringing Ace Steel in for a tryout, and when the invitation was passed on several weeks ago, their belief was that meant he was bound for WWE or AEW. So the timing fits in that a return was on the table for Steel. So that's from Mike Johnson. Sean Ross Sapp added some more to this. Fightful was told there was a meeting this week between AEW and CM Punk, and it was extended to Punk that Steel would have the ability to be with the company and work directly with Punk. However, it was made clear that he would not be able to be at AEW television. We have not learned specifically how Punk reacted to this, outside of him not being in agreement with it. There were plans for an AEW camera crew to film material at Punk's home on Wednesday, but we have not been told if that actually happened. So Johnson and Sapp had far more to say about Punk this week than Brian Alvarez did. But Punk decided to hop on his Instagram stories. He took aim at Alvarez specifically for going on Observer Live and saying that it's not impossible this deal has fallen through. That's in reference to CM Punk returning. On Instagram, Punk told Alvarez to shut the fuck up and stop talking about him. Said, friendly reminder, I haven't been on television in 9 months and you all still can't stop talking about me. Maybe stop, you'll feel better. Love, hate, it's all the same. I don't enjoy being the sole person that props up entire misinformed clickbait industry based on toxic gossip from lying sources. But what can you do? When you're the king, it comes with the crown. One more before I go really quick. The parasocial relationship that some fringe wrestling fans has is unhealthy. I get the tribalism, but picking sides is silly. You don't know me, you don't know anybody else, so just go touch grass. He's right about one thing. The tribalism today is toxic and stupid. That I think we can all agree on. And if you don't agree with that, then you are the problem. Now for his part, Alvarez responded in this way. He said, I didn't get any story wrong. There wasn't one thing I said on the show yesterday that was wrong. I still don't know why this guy spent I don't know how long on Instagram, which to me, it was almost like high art when he spent all this time on Instagram and then finished with a video where he told everyone else to go outside and touch grass. So yeah, I don't know, Phil. You're right. I don't know you. But you know what? I do know a lot of people in AEW. I have heard from people in AEW and I have heard from people in Warner Brothers Discovery. And they all said the same thing. There's an issue. I don't know why you're mad at me. Maybe you should talk to the people in your own company. Or maybe you should talk to the people at Warner Brothers Discovery, which is where I got all the information. I didn't make it up. I didn't make one thing up. Why am I talking about CM Punk? Well, let me think about this. I do a wrestling radio show where my job is to cover wrestlers. You're a wrestler, and you are supposed to be the centerpiece of an announcement, and you weren't. Gee, I wonder why I would be talking about this now. You know what's going on here, and I got sucked into it. I didn't want to. This is the same thing that FTR was doing, and I shouldn't even say FTR. This is the same thing that Dax was doing, and that is to try to create in the minds of the wrestling fans some imaginary beef that I have with Dax Harwood or with CM Punk. I don't have any beef with CM Punk or Dax. You can think what you want of Meltzer and Alvarez, but here's a reality check. They're not the only ones that reported on Brawl Out. You may think they played favorites with one side over the other, but there were lots of different outlets reporting on what happened backstage that night, and the fallout that came after, and then months later the negotiations for Punk to be brought back, the collision rumors, I mean, those go all the way back to February. The reporting on Tony Khan trying to get meetings organized with Punk and other people on the roster, the meeting that allegedly happened with Punk and Chris Jericho a few weeks ago, and now everything that happened this week. Meltzer and Alvarez are not the only two people reporting on this. And all of that is to say that someone, and no, it is not just the elite, people, multiple people within AEW and people within Warner Brothers Discovery, whether it's Mike Johnson or Sean Ross Sapp, or Nick Hausman, or Andrew Zarian, people are speaking to these men and providing them with this information. And if CM Punk has a problem with what's being reported, then he's free to call all of them out for it. But the bigger issue, and the one that I talked about months ago, is that if Punk believes this is all fake news that is being leaked to make him look bad, and none of it is true, how can there ever be trust? Other than the money, why would Punk want to go back and work for a company filled with people that he believes are out to get him and have an agenda and don't want him there? Why would anyone want to work for a place like that? Alvarez is not wrong. If Punk has a problem with what is being reported, he should take it up with Tony Khan and the people in AEW. And if he already has, then good for him. But if we believe that every negative thing that's been said about CM Punk and this whole fiasco is not true, or is being blown out of proportion, then they should have parted ways months ago and saved themselves the headaches and the aggravation. All this is an unnecessary distraction in a week that should have been one of the happiest for AEW. And all it has turned into is another embarrassment for Tony Khan. The one thing I will say about Vince McMahon is that if this were happening in WWE on his watch, he never would have let this shit get to this point. This idea of quietly splitting the rosters so that Punk would be segregated on one show to keep him away from the Elite, if that wasn't a giant red flag right there, I don't know what is. That's a fucking blinking neon billboard is what that is. So none of this is surprising to me. Nick Hausman says that Ace Steel was actually rehired months ago. And if Impact reached out to him weeks ago about a tryout and he turned them down, it's very possible that was because he was already rehired. Hausman said AEW denied that to him when he inquired about it. And AEW denied to Meltzer that Steel was rehired as a producer. Does that mean he wasn't hired as a producer, but maybe he was hired in some other role? That we don't know. It could be that they're playing semantics here. Maybe he wasn't rehired in his old role. Hausman says top people in AEW were not aware of any of this until this week. And when key talent found out about it, they were all shocked. As they have a right to be. Meltzer says Ace Steel returning was apparently one of Punk's requests or demands to return, and that he and Steel were of the impression that Steel would be back in his old role as a producer. And the story is that Tony Khan told Punk, look, he could have his job back, and he could work closely with you, but he would do so remotely and not be brought to the buildings for the shows. And at that point, that's where things fell apart. The Ace Steel stuff is the biggest head-scratcher to me. For weeks now, we've been hearing, you know, rumors and reports and murmurs about apologies and meetings and, you know, legal threats, and mostly about Punk and Jericho and the Elite. I thought we were done with this. I thought the Ace Steel thing was just a thing of the past. The fact that we're still talking about this fucking guy, he was the lone person fired in the aftermath of Brawl Out for allegedly hurling the chair that cracked Nick Jackson in the face, and for biting Kenny Omega, to the point where Omega's arm had visible bite marks on it in the days that followed. There was an actual dog in the dressing room that night, but Ace Steel was the one biting people. He was the only one fired in a company where Tony Khan never fires anybody. I get the impression he doesn't really like confrontation here. I mean, Leva Bates is the latest example of this. They just let your contract expire and they don't say anything. Not even to the talent whose contract is expiring. I mean, look, everybody should know when their contract expires. And if no one is saying anything to you, then you should probably assume that they don't want you back. But I have to admit, that would be very awkward. If I were under contract to a company and I was working there for years and years, and I had a week left, let's say, on my deal, and nobody said anything to me, after all my years there, that would make me very uneasy. That would be a little awkward. But he doesn't fire anybody. But he fired this guy. So for him to be fired, he had to have done something bad. And yet, if these reports are to be believed, the entire deal for Punk to return to build this entirely new franchise around him could possibly fall apart over Ace Steel. Are you fucking kidding me? Ace Steel is not nearly that important to AEW to be the cause of all this. And if that's what's holding things up, I get that Punk wants to do right by his friends. He and Ace Steel go all the way back to the Ring of Honor days. Steel was at ringside in Chicago when Punk beat John Cena to win the title at Money in the Bank. They go back a long way. But if it ends up that that is what blows up this entire thing, then it's time for Tony Khan to cut his losses with Punk and move on. Because someone that did what he supposedly did should not be brought back to work for that company. He's not worth it. And the idea that Tony Khan would secretly hire him back is completely batshit insane. I cannot even fathom that it would have been considered. You know, for someone who supposedly wanted to make amends, the idea that Punk wanted so badly to come back and was about to. He was on the verge of coming back, this big massive announcement, and he supposedly wants to work with Samoa Joe, and so it looks like Tony Khan is gonna have him work with Samoa Joe. Like, all the pieces were falling into place. He was gonna have this entire show on the 17th next month devoted to him at the United Center. He was gonna be promoted as the centerpiece of this new live two-hour show and have input into the talent that he would be working with. He was about to get exactly what he wanted. But that he would blow it up because of Ace Steel. Because he wouldn't be welcomed back into the buildings with him. If that's true, then all that shit that we heard about, apologies and forgiveness. Remember he posted that video on Instagram about forgiveness? That guy that was talking in the video, I can forgive you, but that doesn't mean I have to work with you. All that stuff, it was all bullshit. It was all bullshit. It was all one big giant crock of shit. Maybe he feels guilty that his friend lost his job on account of something that he had nothing to do with, other than being Punk's friend. Maybe he feels he was an innocent victim who was only defending Punk. And he's adamant that he wants his friend to get his job back. That's very noble of him. Delusional, but very noble of him. Punk once bought Joey Mercury's house so that it wouldn't get foreclosed on when Mercury was having drug problems. I get being loyal to your friends. But CM Punk's friendship with Ace Steel should be of no concern to Tony Khan. He assaulted two EVPs. Two EVPs who also happen to be in the middle of contract negotiations and who the company wants very much to keep. So there's a lot riding on whatever decision Tony Khan ultimately makes here. I don't see how you bring that man back. I'm talking about Steel. I don't see how you bring that man back. And now of all times, you can't do it. What kind of message does that send? This is a no-win situation for Tony Khan, because he either gives in and he gives Punk exactly what he wants at the expense of alienating some pretty important people on his roster, and with no guarantee that there won't be some other blow-up in a few months. You know, Punk's got him by the balls in that scenario, or he stands his ground, he loses Punk, and it very well may kill Collision because he was going to build this entire show around a big name that he no longer has. And he's already got some big buildings booked. The announcement's been made. This entire show was built around the idea that CM Punk would be the poster boy for it. And now he wouldn't be. And he's got to find a way to make that show compelling enough to get people to tune in for 2 hours every Saturday night, which is not going to be easy even with Punk. Even with CM Punk, it was going to be a challenge. So it's a no-win situation. Mike Johnson says the plan has long been to hold that first Collision at the United Center. If Punk and AEW can kiss and make up in the next few days, and who's to say they haven't already, then that's still the plan. You know, Tony Khan was on television on Wednesday promising to announce on Dynamite this week the location of that June 17th show. So we're going to know by Wednesday if they're running Chicago or not. If they have Punk, then they run Chicago. If they don't have Punk, I don't see how they can run Chicago. And I don't mean just as far as selling tickets to a building like that, a big building. I mean anywhere in Chicago, the fucking flea market in the parking lot somewhere. How are you going to run Chicago after all this and not have CM Punk on that first show? That's all those people are going to be expecting, is a surprise return for their hometown hero. Even if he's not advertised, he wasn't advertised for the first dance either, but they all knew he would be there. It'll be CM Punk chants all night long, nonstop. But they don't have a lot of time to play with here. You know, I've been talking about Collision being the CM Punk show, but really, I've had it wrong. We've been watching the CM Punk show play out in real time. And it doesn't seem like there's going to be a happy ending to this show, whether it be now, 6 months from now, or a year from now. We'll have a better sense of where things stand on Wednesday. If they announce Chicago as a location, and maybe they announce Punk too, But if they run Chicago, I cannot imagine him not being there. And finally, at long last, it sounds like we may be only days away from an announcement of when people can play AEW Fight Forever. I'm convinced at this point that the reason the game has been delayed is they've been adding a CM Punk mode, maybe a Brawl Out mode. I would love to play that mode more than anything in the ring. You know, Brawl Out mode can just be all this backstage bullshit. You see Tony Khan on screen. You have to make a choice. What decision does he make? Who does he fire? Who does he suspend? You know, we have to schedule a backstage meeting. I'd play that game. Maybe they've been adding that mode. Fightful has learned that an announcement of the release date could come as early as this week, with the date currently scheduled for June 27th, which would be right after Forbidden Door. People figured it was close when the full list of Xbox achievements leaked this week and the game became available to preload. File size comes in at about 17 gigabytes. Those who Fightful has heard from said the game plays very smoothly and resembles WWF No Mercy in that sense, although there are some limitations with the Create a Wrestler mode, and there were no plans for community creations that they heard of the last time they asked.
Hey, it's Chris Van Vliet popping in here because if you enjoy Solomonster, and I mean, how could you not? He's awesome. But if you enjoy Solomonster, I think you might also enjoy my podcast, Insight with Chris Van Vliet. So I've got the YouTube channel and the podcast. And this week on the show, we had Devon Dudley and Freddie Prinze Jr., who will blow you away with his wrestling knowledge. And some of my recent guests include Stone Cold Steve Austin, The Undertaker, Dolph Ziggler, the hilarious Will Sasso, The Rock, and many, many more. You can find my podcast, Insight with Chris Van Vliet, wherever you're listening to this one right now.
WWE is in the middle of its second season of Most Wanted Treasures on A&E. I have not been keeping up with all of the new A&E program. I've been keeping up with enough of the AEW programming. Now we have more coming up. But all of the A&E programming, there we go. But I did see the DX episode where Mick Foley went to Road Dogg's house. He was looking for any DX memorabilia that he might have. He had none because he had a very bad drug problem back in the day. And either he didn't keep a lot of that stuff or he sold it for drugs. But he did have a replica of the old WWF tag team belt in a display case, which he gifted to them. He did admit, though, he couldn't say for sure that it was... In fact, I think he flat out said it probably wasn't one of the actual tag belts he held with Billy Gunn when they had their New Age Outlaws run, and that he may have technically stolen it. It may have technically been a stolen item from the WWF warehouse or backstage area. So basically, he gave this stolen item back to Mick Foley for him to bring back to the warehouse. But they also were looking for one of China's old ring outfits. Lita and Sean Waltman made the trip to Joanie's sister's house. And she didn't have anything as far as outfits or gear. But she did give them some old family photos of Joanie. And then they went searching for the DX Invasion Jeep. And they found it in someone's garage. The son of the person who drove the Jeep the first time. Back in 98 when they tried to invade Nitro. He would not give, the son that is, would not give the Jeep to them, not for the price they were offering, but he agreed to loan it to them. And he said that he would be, you know, the one to drive it to Raw 30. If you remember Raw 30, the beginning of the year, they drove that Jeep into the building when they had a little DX reunion. He was the one driving the Jeep, and that was the original Jeep that they used in that segment back in 98. So that was the DX episode. But when I saw they were doing a Macho Man Randy Savage episode, that got my attention. Top Dollar, by the way, is no longer part of this show. Booker T is now their new head of acquisitions. That is what they are calling him. So it's his job to try to procure some of these collectibles. And he has enlisted the help of Mick Foley and others to go on the road and help find this rare stuff. And now it's their job to lowball people on their offers. Remember season one? Triple H sent Top Dollar around to basically offer $2,500 to everybody. Yeah, not much has changed here. One of the items they were looking for in this episode was the giant Macho Man monster truck that made exactly one appearance on WCW television. It was at Halloween Havoc in 1996. When I think of monster trucks in pro wrestling, I think about Hulk Hogan and the Giant and their monster trucks. Their monster truck battle on the roof of Cobo Hall. and Giant falling off the side of the building. I have no memory of there even being a Macho Man monster truck. But there it was. It was a Ford monster truck owned by Bigfoot 4x4. It had a gigantic yellow fiberglass cowboy hat on the top of it that said Macho, either Macho or Macho Man on it. They found the hat. They did not find the actual monster truck, but they found the hat. It has been sitting in someone's garage. This guy is actually a referee, I guess, for some local indie promotions in the area. And he's had it in his garage. It could not have been for that long, though, because as of a few years ago, it was sitting outside of a thrift store in Illinois, just sitting outside. You know, and obviously the elements have taken a toll on this thing. The Macho Man lettering is mostly worn off, but you can still see the outline of it on the hat. Lita offered the guy, what else? $2,500 for this giant cowboy hat. He asked for $5,300, which is exactly penny for penny, he said, what he paid for it, which is only fair. And they agreed to that deal. We had Mick Foley and Diamond Dallas Page taking a ride, heading to another collector's house to look for the Macho King, Crown and Scepter. This guy has an entire shrine in his home to the Macho Man, including the orange boots that he wore during the famous snakebite angle with Jake Roberts, which is very cool. He had one of the old Macho Man robes, the one that he wore to the ring for the match he had with Hacksaw Jim Duggan, in fact, when he became King back in 89. He had what he claimed he got from another collector that he trusted was the original Macho King crown. It was in a display case. The real deal. And he said he wouldn't put a value on it to sell when they asked him about selling it. But he did agree to loan it to them to put on display with the rest of the Macho King outfit, which he also had. The one thing he did not have was the scepter. He said that's with another collector who doesn't want to give it up. And I can't say I blame them, honestly. Foley took the crown back to Stanford to show it to Ben Brown. Ben Brown is their archivist, and he got some bad news. They compared it to an image of the old crown, and it didn't match up. He said it's possible, maybe, that Savage used it on some house show loops, but he doubts it. So they sent the crown back, because they didn't want to put a crown on display at like fan access and stuff. That was not legitimate. Then they were looking for Savage's old Mega Powers robe, which he only wore twice. The SummerSlam 88 match against DiBiase and Andre, and then the NBC match in 89 against the Twin Towers that led to the breakup of the Mega Powers. As iconic as that run was, it is hard to believe that they only had two matches together. At least televised. I don't know how many house show matches the Mega Powers may or may not have had. But they only had two televised matches together. But see, now you're talking my jam now, right? I was all about the Mega Powers as a kid and the Mega Powers handshake. They found a collector. His father bought the robe years ago in a silent auction. And it's even signed on the inside by the Macho Man. Foley offered him $5,000 for it. And he said, no way. So then Foley went up to $8,500. Again, the guy said, no way. He came back with $10,000. Plus, ringside seats for him and his family to WrestleMania, which would add another $10,000 on top of the $10,000 that he asked for. And Foley accepted the offer. And then the big one was the box of ICW Master Tapes, International Championship Wrestling, run by the Poffo family out of Kentucky, where Macho Man was born. The Macho Man character was born in ICW. 20 boxes of master tapes with episodes that never aired before on television. Basically, these tapes were lost to time. This footage was lost to time. Nobody knew it still existed. Nobody's seen it. As the story goes, and they told it on the episode, there was an oil company called Caspian Oil in Colorado. They loaned money to Angelo Poffo, Randy's father, to start the promotion. And as collateral, he would return the master tapes to them if he was ever unable to pay them back. He obviously couldn't pay them because one day they get a knock at the door and a box of these tapes gets dumped on their doorstep. And so the oil company, they put the tapes away in a storage locker. And they left them there for the last 35 years. They've been sitting there. They never explained how they came to find this out. They never explained who contacted them or how they got them from the oil company. But Ben Brown says, look, we're going to get Lanny to come in and authenticate the tapes. Now, obviously, this was recorded not long before Lanny passed away in February. So they got him to come to the warehouse, and they showed Lanny some of the footage, and he said, oh, God, I've never seen this before. We only got to see snippets, but it was very cool, and it looked to be in good condition, too. This was the first confirmation that WWE now owns the ICW tapes. So that's why at the beginning of the show, when I said they kind of broke news on this episode, I don't think anybody was aware of that. They may have assumed that WWE, maybe they had it or they were going after it. But this is the first confirmation that we have that they are in possession of the only known master tapes from ICW. It's why a lot of people were nervous, myself included, when this talk was going on for months about a potential WWE sale and who might end up buying the company, because WWE, they own so many different libraries. They basically own all of wrestling history. You know, Jim Crockett Promotions, Mid-South, World Class, WCW, ECW, AWA, and now ICW, among others. They have the OVW library, too, although I don't think they ever put an OVW library up on Peacock. But they own all of this stuff. And maybe a new owner wouldn't prioritize that. Maybe they would stash it away, never to be seen. You just don't know. I don't think that's going to happen under Endeavor. I think they'll just let WWE run things the way pretty much that they do now. But it would be nice to see them start rolling out some of these ICW episodes on Peacock soon. I would love to see more of that early Macho Man footage. So I enjoyed this. They dedicated the episode at the very end. They had a graphic for Lanny Poffo. I enjoyed this, and I know I'm going to enjoy tonight's episode, because tonight's episode is focused on Bret the Hitman Hart. He had his WrestleMania 8 jacket stolen from him, and he is looking to get it back. And we'll see what other artifacts they can find. If I have any of it stashed away myself, I got some Bret Hart items here, but I'm certainly not telling them about it. I'll tell them what they can do with their $2,500. All right, let's get to your mailbag questions. We got some good shit here to go through. Keep emailing me, thesolemnmonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. This, I got a couple of questions about this, and so I figure we'll cover this at the top. James from Long Island says, WWE put out a video ranking the top 25 debuts in WWE history. What do you think of their list? And what would you say is the greatest debut ever in WWE? So I watched this video that they put up on their YouTube channel, and it's a WWE list. So, of course, it's going to have some questionable choices. Any list that's 25 deep is going to have some questionable placements. When they talk about greatest debuts, we don't know if they're talking about the moment itself. Are they including the overall influence on this person in the company? You know, like if they went on to become something really big. So, you know, they're ranking their debut high because of that. I don't know what their criteria is. But let's go through this. We'll start from number 25. We'll work backwards to number 1. And I'll chime in along the way with my thoughts. Number 25 on the list is Solo Sikoa, who debuted in the main event of Clash at the Castle in front of 62,000 people in Cardiff last year. Interfered in the main event between Roman Reigns and Drew McIntyre. And that is a hell of a spot to make your debut. You spend over a year in NXT, and all of a sudden your first appearance on the main roster, and you are costing Drew McIntyre the championship against Roman Reigns. You are saving the reign of Roman Reigns. So that's a pretty big way to make a debut. Number 24, Santino Marella, who won the Intercontinental Championship in his debut. I think, if anything, this is too low. I would have this a little higher up, probably somewhere at least between 10 and 20. Number 23, Shinsuke Nakamura. Now, they are talking about, I believe they're talking about the main roster debuts. His main roster debut, I remember it, because Miz and Maurice were in the ring. And this would have been, I guess, after WrestleMania 33, I guess, when Miz had that mixed tag match with Cena and with Nikki Bella. But we had, and I forgot his name, this great violinist who came out. Lee, was it Lee? I forgot his name, but he came out, he started playing the violin, and it was a great entrance. It was a great entrance, but it doesn't hold a candle to his NXT debut in Dallas, and I was in the building for that, for his match with Sami Zayn, his very first appearance in WWE, and it was incredible. So, I mean, if you wanted to include his NXT debut, we would have to bump that up a whole bunch of spots. As far as his main roster debut, I guess you could say top 25. It might be on there somewhere. Number 22 is the Usos and Tamina. I have no memory of this whatsoever. Number 21, Baron Corbin, who won the Andre Battle Royal at WrestleMania 32. He dumped out Kane to win the Andre Battle Royal trophy. Right, they claimed 101,000 people in the building at WrestleMania. That was Baron Corbin's main roster debut. Number 20 was Umaga. That was the night after WrestleMania 22. Came to the ring. He got introduced by Armando Alejandro Estrada. He came to the ring. He had the wild hair. This is before he was, you know, braiding it back. And he beat up Ric Flair in his very first appearance. He laid out Ric Flair. Number 19, Rey Mysterio, who debuted on SmackDown back in 2002. I believe he wrestled Chavo in his debut match, and I think he came back out that night at the end of the show and did a big dive off the top of the steel cage, I want to say, onto the Un-Americans, if I'm remembering correct. Number 18, I got a beef with this one. Number 18 is The Nexus. I don't know how they came to slot this in at number 18, but this absolutely should be a top 10 debut. I think it is ridiculous that it is not much lower on this list. That is one of the greatest angles they've ever shot in the history of Monday Night Raw. And the fact that they got buried 2 months later should have no impact on the fact that the Nexus debut itself and what happened that night and just the chaos that ensued and how real it felt. They did a very good job of making that feel genuine and getting a lot of people talking and getting people concerned who bought into it as a shoot. There were people who did. They beat up the announcers. They pulled up the mats. They showed us the fucking plywood boards under the mat, which we had never seen before, right? All this mass carnage. We had never seen anything like this before. They beat up John Cena. They beat up CM Punk. The fans had voted CM Punk in the main event that night to wrestle John Cena. They had fan voting. Punk, this was during the phase where he was wearing a lucha mask. And Punk was a heel. And he got in on it too. That's one of those little things that made it feel more genuine is the fact that, well, John Cena is the babyface, so, you know, he's getting beaten up and they're leaving CM Punk. No, Punk came in. He tried to go after these guys. They beat him up too. They did an incredible job with that angle. And it was honestly the closest thing to an NWO-esque angle that we had since the original NWO. The fact that they put this in the number 18 spot is ridiculous. Number 17, Asuka. And again, I could tell you I have no memory of how she debuted on the main roster. Number 16 was Carlito. I believe Carlito won the U.S. title on his first night. Right? It was the first night, not the following week. So that was a pretty memorable debut. Number 15 was too, like whether you like the guy or not, the Great Khali. And I will give them that. It deserves a place here on this list. Probably top 20. It was on SmackDown. It was a match between Undertaker and Mark Henry. Undertaker was beating him up outside the ring, and all of a sudden, no music or anything. Here comes Daivari with the Great Khali, leading this giant man down the aisle. Undertaker looks up and he sees this, and Khali is in the ring. Undertaker gets in the ring and goes, you know, face to chest with Khali. And Khali beats him down, hits him with a brain chop, and he boots him down. And if you had never seen this guy before, I mean, he looks like this giant monster, you know, who's kind of, I would imagine it was the way a lot of kids felt when they were watching Giant Gonzalez. When he debuted at the Rumble in 93 and he eliminated The Undertaker, and it was almost the same thing. It was almost a carbon copy. I mean, it wasn't the Royal Rumble, but it was almost a carbon copy of the exact same thing. But it's a memorable moment, so I'm willing to accept that. You know, the Khali debut would be that high on the list. Number 14 was Braun Strowman. That would have been when he debuted as part of the Wyatt family. Number 13 was Sting, who debuted at Survivor Series back in 2014 and helped beat the Authority when he dragged Dolph Ziggler on top of, I guess it was Seth Rollins, right, for the winning pinfall in that match, and he gave Triple H a Scorpion Death Drop, and then he walked out. Better we don't talk about what happened at WrestleMania with Sting, but that was a memorable debut. He was the one that we never thought, and I never thought, Vince would get his hands on. Not at that point. At that point, I thought, too much time has gone by, he's too old. If it hasn't happened by now, it's never going to happen. You know, whatever his reservations were about not coming to WWE, you know, why would he change now? But, you know, money talks, and people change their minds, and so there was Sting for the first time on WWE television in 2014 after this long career and all the years he spent in TNA, he kept re-signing with Dixie. It was a big deal to see Sting for the first time on WWE television. Or shall I say, the vigilante. Number 12 is The Undertaker, who debuted at the Survivor Series in 1990. He was the Million Dollar Man's mystery man, mystery partner, in his Survivor Series match. That's a memorable one. Number 11 was Booker T, who debuted as part of the Invasion angle. He gave an axe kick, I believe, right, to Steve Austin during the main event of the King of the Ring pay-per-view in 2001. Then he put Austin through a table. I think that's where Austin broke his hand. Then we get into the top 10. And if I had an issue with the placement of the Nexus, I have an issue with the placement of this. Number 10, the very bottom of the top 10, is Chris Jericho. Ranking Chris Jericho's debut at number 10 on a list of greatest WWE debuts is a travesty. And I saw Jericho, he quote tweeted the list on Twitter. I think he said, "Hold my beer." Yeah, I mean, that's, I don't even know what to say to that. To put it at number 10, gotta be people who were newer fans or younger fans. They just don't have a concept of how big of a deal that was. When he debuted, and it wasn't even just the night he debuted, it was the build-up to it, and all the fans who knew of Chris Jericho from WCW, and they heard the rumors, and people had signs in the crowd for weeks on television even leading up to this, and they had the Millennium Countdown. The way they did this was just fucking brilliant. And then the actual debut itself, he had that badass music. As soon as they threw the name Jericho up on that screen, you had The Rock standing in the middle of the ring. He interrupted The Rock. And they threw the name Jericho up on the screen and the place exploded. I think they were in Chicago and the building exploded. They knew exactly who this man was. And yes, The Rock, you know, he insulted him. He you know, tried to make him feel less than. And you could certainly nitpick what they did as far as having Rock berate him and belittle him. But it doesn't take away from the fact that Jericho got to go toe-to-toe on the microphone in his debut on Raw when it was at its absolute peak of popularity with one of the biggest stars in the entire business. Arguably the number two. Or if you want to say Austin Rock 1A, 1B, he was right there. One of the biggest stars in the entire business. How the fuck do you put Chris Jericho's debut at number 10? I don't understand. Number 9 was John Cena when he came out on SmackDown in 02, Ruthless Aggression, and he wrestled Kurt Angle. That's a very memorable one that belongs in the top 10. Number 8, Kevin Owens. Now, Kevin Owens had a very memorable main roster debut. He answered the U.S. title open challenge of John Cena, if I remember correctly, or this was around the time that Cena was doing the U.S. open challenge stuff. He didn't wrestle him on his first night, but he was the NXT champion at the time. It was a big shock to see him walk out there on Raw. And he left John Cena laying. And then 2 weeks later, at the pay-per-view that they had, he went in there and he beat John Cena. He pinned John Cena. And that just wasn't something that happened very often back then. But I would even lump in the NXT debut. Not only did Kevin Owens have a memorable main roster debut, he had a memorable NXT debut because his very first NXT show was Our Evolution. And he was in the opening match against CJ Parker, right, the current Juice Robinson. He got his nose busted open. It was a quick match, a quick win for Owens. But then, of course, he came back out at the end of the night when his good friend Sami Zayn became the NXT champion. And he hugged him and he embraced him. And then he betrayed him. And he powerbombed him on the apron of the ring. I'd say that was a pretty memorable debut for Kevin Owens. So he's one of the few to have not just one, but two memorable debuts. Where he slots in the top 10, is he number 8? Is it number 6? I don't know. I mean, we could quibble over that, but he absolutely deserves a spot in the top 10. Number 7 is The Rock. This one was weird to me. I know why they put him there, because of what he would go on to become. And in his debut, he debuted at Madison Square Garden. He debuted at the Survivor Series, and he won. They put him in an elimination match. Big pineapple head, Rocky Maivia comes out, big cheesy smile on his face, and he won. He won his debut at Madison Square Garden. So I get it. I get why they would want him on this list. It doesn't crack my top 10, I don't think. I'm looking at this list at some of the other ones they have on here, and I would put them ahead of The Rock. Number 6, AJ Styles. Definitely worthy, despite them almost ruining it with their camera work. Roman Reigns, with that confused look on his face, they lingered on him for far too long. But AJ's debut at the Royal Rumble in 2016 is definitely top 10 worthy. Brock Lesnar is another one. Brock Lesnar is on their list at number 5. Great. A great debut. I remember watching that live. I'd never seen Brock Lesnar before, didn't know who he was. Just by looking at him, he looked like fucking Frankenstein. He looked like a very scary individual. And then you saw Paul Heyman with him. We had not seen Paul Heyman in many months since he got fired from the announce booth and they brought back Jerry Lawler and they carried Heyman out, kicking and screaming. So seeing Heyman with him was exciting because we had not seen Paul Heyman in a managerial role in WWE. He hadn't been a manager since the Paul E. Dangerously days. But this fucking guy, I mean, Lesnar comes out there looking like just made out of granite and he is just laying waste to everybody. And then poor Spike Dudley. I mean, it's tough to go back and watch what he did to Spike, and Spike took a lot of abuse during his career, right? Going back to the ECW days. But man, I mean, Brock, he powerbombed the shit out of this guy, and you can see his head smacking over and over against the mat. This was about as impactful a debut, physically, as I've ever seen. And then, of course, we all know what he would go on to accomplish. So, Brock being in the top 5, you know what? That sounds about right to me. What I disagree with is number 4. Number 4 is Ronda Rousey. And what they're talking about is Ronda's debut at the Royal Rumble. Not even her first match or anything. But her appearance at the Royal Rumble back in 2018, where she came out. And that would have been, I guess, the very first Women's Rumble. Asuka won that Rumble. Asuka was in the ring. She had Charlotte Flair on one side holding up her SmackDown Women's Championship. Alexa Bliss on the other side of her holding up the Raw Women's Championship. And then we hear Bad Reputation. And here comes Ronda Rousey in her leather jacket. She gets in the ring and she very awkwardly stands there and points at the WrestleMania sign. And then they all gaze up at the WrestleMania sign. And I guess, you know, for them it's a very symbolic thing because of what Ronda represented. It was a new phase for the women's division. All this attention now because of Ronda that was going to be shown. They just had their first Women's Rumble. So it's a symbolic thing. Her debut does not belong to even sniff the top 10. I have no idea how this made the top 25, let alone the top 5. Ronda had one of the greatest debut matches at WrestleMania that year against Triple H and Stephanie. It was her and Kurt Angle against Triple H and Stephanie. But her actual debut does not belong on here. Certainly not this high up on the list. Number 3 is Goldberg, who debuted on Raw the night after WrestleMania 19, right? That would have been 2003. Rock was in the ring. He was already being showered by Goldberg chants, and he told the people, "Stop talking about my accountant, Ira Goldberg." He tried his best to try to deflect. But then they cut to the back, and we saw Goldberg. He was wearing his own leather jacket or whatever it was, bomber jacket, and he's coming out to the ring. They circle each other. He spears the Rock. Right, the last really big star from the WCW guys, WCW days, to come over to WWE, other than Sting. And it was a big moment. You know, Goldberg's debut got a big reaction. He was a big name. Is he number 3? No. Not on my list. Is it top 10? Probably. I don't think I would have it at number 3, though. No, definitely not. Number 2, Kane. This is the only choice, in my opinion, for number one. If you had Kane at number two, okay, fine. As they do have Kane at number two. But on my list, Kane is number one. You're not going to find a better WWE debut than Kane. This is a story that was built up over a period of many months. And at that show, we had the very first Hell in a Cell match between Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker, which is an absolute classic gem of a match. It is still, in my opinion, the greatest Hell in a Cell match that that company has ever produced. One of the greatest matches, really, in the history of that company. They had two of them that year. They had that one, and they had the Bret Hart-Steve Austin match from WrestleMania 13. So, even though business was lean for most of that year, they ended up getting two of their best matches ever, and the most infamous match in company history at the Survivor Series that year. 97, let me tell you. Looking back on it now, 97 was a hell of a trip. Plus the Hart Foundation, US angle. What a fucking year. But Kane comes out, flames shooting up, wearing the original mask, the original Kane outfit, looking like a fucking demon walking down to this ring. Undertaker's in the ring, shocked look on his face. He can't believe what he's seeing. Is that his brother? He comes down to the cage. He grabs the door. He rips the door off its hinges. Gets in the ring. Stands face to face with his older brother. Shoots pyro out of the ring post. Three of them anyway. One of them didn't shoot off. And then he gives him a tombstone and he leaves. So he debuts in the main event of this pay-per-view, the very first ever Hell in a Cell match, to attack The Undertaker, to lay out The Undertaker, and actually leads into the finish, and Shawn Michaels then pins The Undertaker, which then sent him to Montreal to challenge for the championship, because the winner was going to go on to wrestle Bret Hart for the title. But just the presentation, the outfit, the pyro, the lighting, the music, the mood, even the commentary, Vince McMahon, that's gotta be Kane, and ripping the door off its... All of it, the total package. You will not find a better debut in this company than Kane. And then you take into consideration, of course, the longevity that he had. I don't think there's a fucking person who could have predicted the kind of run that Kane would go on to have. Because so many times they would feed Undertaker these big giant monsters and he would slay them and that would be it. And frankly, some of them just weren't very good. But this guy came in, and he ends up sticking around for over 20 years. And not only that, but he turned out to be pretty damn good. So, again, I have Kane at number one. They have Kane at number two. That's fine. Number one on their list, the number one greatest debut in WWE history, is The Shield from Survivor Series in 2012. Worthy of the top 10, certainly. The top spot? No. And I say that as a Shield fan. You guys know I'm a big fan of The Shield. But as the number one debut in company history, not even close. Worthy of top 10 because they debuted in the main event of Survivor Series and they attacked John Cena and Ryback, right? They were attacking some big names. They made an impression on night one. And they were main event stars from the moment they debuted in that company. They didn't have to work their way from the bottom and go out and win a bunch of mid-card titles, even though, you know, Ambrose won the U.S. title. They debuted as top stars from day one. But it is not the number one best debut in company history. I know why that's on there, because all three of them went on to become champions and to become main eventers and future Hall of Famers, and they're all doing big things, right? No one bigger than Roman right now. But that alone does not make this the number one best debut. Kane and Chris Jericho are the two best WWE debuts of all time. I would have Kane at number one and Chris Jericho right behind him at number two. And I'll tell you what, I might even go Nexus at number three. I think I might I'd have to think about it, but I think I might have Nexus at number three. I could certainly make the argument for Nexus being number three. Again, how the hell are you going to rank the Nexus behind Braun Strowman and Asuka? It's ridiculous. How is Taz not ranked anywhere in the top 25? Taz is another one. I would even entertain the idea of Taz as number three. If not number three, then definitely in my top five. Yeah, I mean, he went on and didn't become a champion, didn't become a big star, as big as maybe he should have been. Very disappointing, frankly, to see the kind of run he ended up having, I think, compared to what people were hoping for and expecting. And certainly the reaction he got that night at Madison Square Garden at the Royal Rumble when they hit his music, the place exploded because it was New York. And he's a New Yorker, and they knew who he was. And he comes out, towel over the head, right, looking like a badass. He's suplexing Kurt Angle all over the place. He beats Kurt Angle. Kurt Angle had not been beaten up to that point. He hadn't been around very long. He had only debuted, I guess, 2 months before this, but he had been undefeated up to that point. He comes in, he wrecks this guy, he passes out, the place goes nuts, Taz leaves the ring, walks right to the back. Kurt has to get stretchered out. This was his debut in Madison Square Garden. How is he not ranked in the top 25? Why? Because he went on to fizzle out and not become a big name in WWE? So what? We're talking about top debuts. He belongs in the top 25. He belongs in the top 10. Where's Big Show on this list? Now that I say these two names, I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, how many names on this, let me see here, how many names on this list are currently in AEW? Let's see. Well, we know Ambrose is there, right? So we have the Shield in the number one spot. We have got Sting. He's currently in AEW. I think that might be about it, right? Not too many AEW people here on this list. Maybe that has something to do with it. Maybe they didn't want to give too much. Oh, I guess Jericho too. But I don't know. Maybe they didn't want to go wild with all the AEW names. But like Big Show, he cut through the ring in the middle of the Austin McMahon cage match at St. Valentine's Day Massacre. And he threw Stone Cold Steve Austin through the side panel of the cage. Now, it ended up winning the match for Austin, which kind of made Big Show look like a dumbass, I guess. But that was still a pretty cool debut. That was a pretty important way to debut in the company, right? Trying to help the owner of the company beat your top star. Coming up through the ring, Eric Bischoff. Coming out to be announced as the Raw GM and hugging Vince McMahon, right? It looked like hell had frozen over. How's that not on this list? What about Paige? We have a couple of people on this list who won championships in their debut. Why not Paige? She debuted the night after WrestleMania, beat AJ Lee, won the Women's Championship. So there were definitely names that were conspicuously absent from this list. I'll throw one more at you. I'll throw Sami Zayn in there. Sami Zayn, it was not meant to be his official main roster debut even before he got hurt, but he made his Raw debut on the show in 2015. And think about this. He came out to accept John Cena's U.S. title open challenge, being introduced by Bret Hart in Montreal, in his hometown of Montreal, introduced by Bret Hart to wrestle John Cena. That's a pretty big fucking debut right there. Now, he got hurt when he was flailing his arms around. He was so excited during his entrance, he tore his rotator cuff. He wrestled that match with a torn rotator cuff. He missed a lot of time after that. But that was a hell of a debut. I don't know how that's not on the list. So let me know what you guys think. I'm very curious where you think these debuts rank and some of my choices as compared to the ones they made. I'm sure everyone's list is going to look different. It's always fun to have a debate about this, but there's always just a few head scratchers that I look at and I go, what the fuck were they thinking? You know, I know sometimes what they like to do. They want to have contemporary people on these lists. Because they, you know, their audience, they know who Asuka is and they know who Braun Strowman. So I get that, right? I understand why they make some of the choices they do. But as far as the placement of some of these choices, I would love to know who they have there putting these lists together. Jack from San Diego. Do you think if Cody Rhodes had never joined AEW and went back to WWE after his New Japan Ring of Honor run, that he would have been treated as big of a star as he has been, or do you believe his time in AEW is what made Vince McMahon view him as a bigger star? Well, I think that's the only reason Vince McMahon viewed him as a bigger star. That's the only reason Vince McMahon and Bruce Pritchard flew down to meet with Cody to talk about him coming back to the company. And the only reason why they agreed with Cody when Cody told them, I don't want to change anything about who I am and what I do. My entrance, my music, the logo, the American Nightmare stuff, it has to all be the same. And they agreed. And he said, like, Vince even made the comment, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. We're not planning on changing anything. Yeah, I mean, if that AEW run doesn't happen, then the answer is no. The entire reason why they saw him as a bigger star was because of the success that he had in AEW and his presentation and his entrance and all of it in AEW. That's the only reason why. Lance from Kentucky, big fan of the podcast. It's helped me survive my long drives home from my night shift. I'm a fan of Orange Cassidy, but when he won the All-Atlantic title, I had admittedly low expectations for it. It's turned out to be really good so far. My question for you is, what title reign did you expect to suck or not have much hope for that surpassed your expectations? The Orange Cassidy one for the All-Atlantic Championship. It was funny about that also is apparently the reason why, or one of the reasons why they've kept his run so strong in the sense that he's been a fighting champion and he's always defending the title on TV, and they really have elevated that title higher on the list there than the TNT Championship, is I guess because they kind of had an idea in mind to make that one of the top titles featured on Collision. And we'll see, you know, when Collision debuts, if we end up getting more international title defenses on Saturdays than we do on Wednesdays. But I guess that was one of the, you know, kind of decisions they made. We got to really boost this title and, what'd they say, level it up when they changed the name of it, right? Tony Khan says we're leveling up the All-Atlantic title. That was one of the decisions, I guess, that they made, is that that might end up being a championship that's featured more often on the Saturday show. As far as other title reigns, it ended up being better than I expected them to be. I don't know. I mean, I'd have to think about that. I'm trying to think of some of the more recent champions that we've had. There was an Intercontinental title run that Miz had. I want to say, was it back in 2016 maybe, or 2017? And for a while there, Miz did a hell of a job of restoring some real value, I thought, to the Intercontinental title. At a time when I had basically written it off because they just were so disinterested in doing anything meaningful with that championship. And also, I probably had just grown disinterested in The Miz. So the fact that he went and had the kind of run that he did there for a while, maybe I'd put that on the list. But as far as other ones, I don't know. I don't know. Any that exceeded my expectations? I don't know. I'd have to think about that some more. That's a good question. Tay from DC. I recently saw a clip of Ric Flair talking about Scott Hall and Kevin Nash in a negative way. And I wanted to know if you knew about any animosity between the three during their runs in WWE or WCW. I believe this is an older clip of him saying this stuff. Yeah, what you're probably referring to is the Legends Roundtable that Flair was on. It aired on the old WWE 24/7 service, which was a precursor to the WWE Network. I used to love those roundtables. I don't know if they have them archived anywhere on Peacock right now. Flair absolutely buried the Outsiders. He buried the NWO. He said it was the worst faction in the history of wrestling. He said it was the worst thing to ever happen to the business. He said they made a living out of destroying the entire company just to get themselves over. I love how, by the way, he says this as complimentary as he is to Hulk Hogan, because the two of them have always been friends, and he will not utter Hogan's name really in a negative light. He did not utter Hogan's name when he says that. He just says that, you know, the NWO in general was the worst thing to happen to the wrestling business. You could certainly have that opinion, but to suggest that that was just a Hall and Nash issue and leave Hogan out of the conversation is being disingenuous. But he said that Kevin Nash has no talent. He said zero talent. He was just a basketball player turned bouncer at a strip club who was in the right place at the right time. And then last year on his podcast, he said he only said those things out of anger. And he says the NWO was actually a great faction. So whatever it was that he was angry about, I guess he's not angry about it anymore. Maybe it was the near-death experience that he had. So maybe now he's all very complimentary of Kevin Nash and all of them. Until Nash says something negative about him, which he won't. He was very appreciative of Rick getting in touch with him after, you know, Nash's son passed away, given that Rick also had a son who passed away. They seem to be very friendly now, but All it would take is one comment by Nash on his podcast, and I'm sure he would be back to being a no-talent stiff who didn't know how to work. That's just how Flair is. Alex in Laguna Beach, California. I wish I was in Laguna Beach right now. Says, I love and mostly agree with your takes. I'm curious if you have an answer to this. I'm watching a YouTube video about interviews regarding Triple H quad tear through the years. They obviously mentioned the match with the two-man power trip against Jericho and Benoit for the tag team titles. My question is whether or not Austin and Hunter were supposed to win, given the dominance that we see today with the Bloodline, and if they had to call an audible that night because of Triple H's injury, or was the plan for Benoit and Jericho to win all along? It was the plan all along. Austin had accidentally cost Triple H the Intercontinental title at Judgment Day, the night before. Kane won the championship. And so then the next night on Raw, the finish was to be Triple H, which it was. It ended up being this way anyway. Triple H accidentally hits Austin with the sledgehammer, and it cost them the tag team titles. So the two-man power trip was clearly going to be coming to an end soon. And I remember reading at the time that the original plan was for Triple H to go babyface and feud with Austin for the championship, probably at SummerSlam that year. Which would have been a role reversal from their feud at the beginning of the year, where Triple H was the heel, Austin was the babyface. If you remember, Triple H beat Austin in that Three Stages of Hell match before WrestleMania. So he would have had a valid claim to say, look, I beat you once, I can beat you again. But then Triple H got hurt, and it affected a lot of things because of the Triple H injury, they booked a TLC match on the fly for SmackDown that week. That was TLC 3, which is where Benoit hurt his neck. Only he didn't know it at the time, or at least he didn't know how serious it was. They didn't know the severity of it until the match at King of the Ring with Austin, Jericho, and Benoit. And then after that, Benoit just disappeared. And he ended up missing, I think, over a year after his neck surgery. He and Triple H both. They missed the entire invasion angle. And how the invasion would have affected those plans, I don't know. So, if the idea was Triple H against Austin at SummerSlam, but then the WCW guys invade, how does that affect things, right? I mean, I've always been of the impression that, maybe the Kurt Angle spot in the invasion stuff would have gone to Triple H. So there's a lot of what-ifs as far as how the invasion would have affected that, but the two-man power trip was on its way out. Mike from New Boston, New Hampshire. John Cena has 16 world titles. Randy Orton has 14. But which one was the better mid-card champion? Interesting. Orton had a pretty good run as the Intercontinental Champion in 2004. At the time, I think he became the longest reigning IC champ in many, many years. Cena held the United States Championship 5 times, which I think is more than anyone else who ever held that title in WWE. Of the two, I think more about Cena and his U.S. title open challenge from 2015. He really made that title something special and had some great matches on TV during that period against people even that you wouldn't ordinarily expect him to be in the ring with. With Orton's run, the only match that really stands out to me is the hardcore match at Backlash with Mick Foley. So I've got to give Cena the edge. I think Cena was the better mid-card champion. Alberto from Laredo, Texas. Do you think The Rock made a good decision leaving wrestling for Hollywood? It's been 20 years since he's been a full-timer. He has had good movies that draw lots of money, but his movies are usually panned by critics, and he hasn't had that one franchise that has been successful in both. What do you think? Yeah, I would say that he made the right decision. He's only one of the biggest stars in the entire world who's made multi-millions more doing movies than he ever did doing wrestling. Which, by the way, when he came back to wrestling, he was a much bigger star for having gone to Hollywood. So, Alberto, yes, the answer is unequivocally, without any hesitation whatsoever, I think The Rock made the correct decision. I think he made the right decision not taking bumps for another 10 to 15 years and going to Hollywood instead. And Michael from Woodbridge, Ontario, Canada. Based on his relevancy in the world of pro wrestling, are you able to see the likes of one Dave Meltzer making it into the WWE Hall of Fame? I've been debating this with my cousin based on how it is a Vince McMahon decision for who gets in, but humor me if you will. Dead or alive, is Big Dave in the Hall of Fame? Absolutely not. They are more likely to put Dave Chappelle in their Hall of Fame before they put Dave Meltzer in there. That will be the day. Who would do the induction? If he actually did go in, who would do the induction for Meltzer? Kenny Omega. If you have questions for the mailbag, keep emailing me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Always love hearing from you guys, even though I don't get to get you all on here. I try to get to as many as I can. So go ahead and do that. Also, follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster, and subscribe to the YouTube channel. Tons of new content and live streams go up on that YouTube channel each and every week. I'm live on Mondays after Raw, Wednesdays after Dynamite, Fridays after SmackDown. Now we have Collision coming up. Ugh, God. Pay-per-views, right? We got a busy weekend coming up next weekend. We have Night of Champions next Saturday, and I will be live as soon as that show is over. So probably, it's a 1 o'clock start, so I'll probably be live around 4 Eastern on YouTube, probably around then. You could listen to the stream, you could watch me, and then go have dinner. Then we have the podcast, episode 810 is next Sunday, but you're also getting a second show because we have Double or Nothing. Double or Nothing and NXT Battleground are going head-to-head. I'll give you one guess which one I'm watching. And when Double or Nothing is over, I'll be live on YouTube for that as well. So we have that. We have brand new episodes of Sound Off Gamer going up every week. So go check out Solomonster Sounds Off on YouTube. Until next Sunday, be well, stay safe. Thank you for all the support, all the love, and I will see you back here for more Sound Off on a very busy weekend, a very busy Memorial Day weekend coming up next week. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonster Sounds Off.
Here is who was in this illustrious Andre the Giant Memorial Battle Royal. Bobby Lashley, Braun Strowman, LA Knight, Xavier Woods, Baron Corbin, Karrion Kross, Bronson Reed, Johnny Gargano, Dexter Lumis, Madcap Moss, Shelton Benjamin, Solomonster, Elias,
Rick Boogs, Mustafa Ali, Dolph Ziggler, Butch, Ridge Holland, Santos Escobar, Ashanti the Adonis, Top Rope Dalla, Los Lothario, Cedric Alexander, Carl Anderson,
Gallows,
Mate, Mansla, Joaquin Wild, and Cruz Delta.
There is the roster for this illustrious battle royal. I stuck an extra one in there just to make sure you were paying attention.
The Solomonster Sounds Off. Each week, bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow the Solomonster on Twitter @Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Solomonster. Solomonster Sounds Off.